In this session, we're on number 11, and we're going to talk about the purpose bridge to the main idea. You know that they have allowed women into the army now, right? So this is what they do. The women just walk all over the guys so they can... This is the purpose, and this is the bridge. Now, the idea, of course, is in the purpose bridge. Let's see, where is that purpose bridge? It's there, right? Normally, right here, I give everybody a little quiz. But everybody's eating sandwiches right now. So let's just do it as a class, okay? So what do we have here?
Text.
Very good. So that's the text. And where are we going to hear?
Sermon.
Good. So there's sermon. Now as we go through these, what do we have that makes our first and seventh set? Flesh. The flesh of the sermon, the flesh of the text, flesh of the sermon. They're both going to have a skeleton. So I hope that your skeleton of the text is going to match the skeleton of the sermon. Pretty much, you know. Shouldn't be completely different. And then heart. The idea is to get to the heart of the passage so you know what the heart of your sermon is. And then brain. So you're using your brain to bring yourself, your people, from the text over to sermon. So now we have the seven steps. First being... study. So study, that's what we've been doing. You ask questions of the text, you answer those questions, you try to really understand what the text is actually saying. And once you kind of know what it's saying, you should be able to do the structure. You'll be able to get the kind of, this text is like two movements, maybe three movements. Some might say four movements. Don't say this text has 16 different movements. You know, that means you don't understand it. You're just seeing all these disconnected things, you know? And that's all moving us up to CPT, which stands for central proposition of the text. Take that text, make it one sentence. That means you're cutting out a whole lot of other things to give that one sentence. And now in this session, we're going to go, we're going to talk about purpose bridge and how that moves us on over to number 5, central proposition of the sermon. Okay? Homiletical idea or main idea or big idea. Structure is parallel to number 6. Step is? Structure. Yeah, it's structure. That's actually easy to... And then we finally get what is parallel to studying the text is actually preach. Preach the text. All right? That's the basic idea. I want to keep reviewing this so you've got this down and you can actually draw out a little chart or a little piece of paper and you can actually do this. Those are 13 different words here. I think you can do it. I hope you can do it. All right? What we don't want is we don't want the people to say, our speaker today is an SVC graduate, so we can be sure the message will be clear, well-prepared, backed by years of understanding. And you're back there trying to figure out, wow, what's the main idea? What's this? What? You know? Know your purpose. Know what? And you're not going to know your purpose until you've done the exegetical work. You're also not going to know your purpose until you have gone through these three developmental questions. You're saying, boy, this text, am I going to basically explain this text to the people because they don't really understand it? Or do they understand it, but they don't really believe it? This sermon is going to be more about proving it to them. Or you're going to say, wow, they already believe it. They already understand it. Like love. They know we should love each other. They understand what that means. I don't need to prove it to them. How do I need to apply it? If I was going to preach to you on love, that's what I would do. You guys know what love is. I don't have to prove to you that we should be loving people. But I would pray that God would help me to help you really think through how how to apply that so that you can really love others more. And the center of the whole process is these steps 4, 5, and 6, going from CPT to CPS, going from exegetical idea to homiletical idea. And the way you do that is you figure out what the desired listener response is. That's how I am referring to the purpose. What is my desire? What do I want the people to do as a result of me preaching the sermon? Okay, so here's some of the definitions that hopefully will underscore these things. When we're talking about exegetical idea, and I'm on page 40 now in your notes, it summarizes the text message to the biblical audience. So this is what I want you to do for Colossians 4:6 next week. You should have the word Colossians in your exegetical idea. You know? The way the Colossians, or the manner, or the way the, or the result of the Colossians doing something, or the reason the Colossians, whatever, something like that. Because that's the biblical audience. Those are the ones that Paul wrote Colossians 4:6 to, right? The sermon's purpose, I'm calling also the desired listener response, is a behavior change you want the hearers as a result of your preaching the homiletical idea. You don't maybe know what the homiletical idea is yet, but you're on your way to thinking what, maybe you're thinking in terms of what the homiletical idea is, and then you're backtracking to think in terms of the purpose. I don't know. Maybe you're doing both at the same time. Maybe it's purpose bridge all the way over to the homiletical idea. But the homiletical idea, or the CPS, summarizes the sermon for the modern audience. All right. Those are your steps 3, 4, 5. All right, let's see where it shows up. Like a bullseye. You know? People often don't preach like that. People often will preach like this. They take their marker and there we go. Check that out. I got a bullseye. See how good I am at darts? Because I'm able to throw the dart right in the middle of my target. Because I'm just so good at all this, you know? You go, well, that's a little bit ridiculous of a way to play darts. You don't just throw it against the wall first and then you draw your target around it. Aren't you supposed to have the target first and then you kind of shoot for the target? Isn't that the way you're supposed to do it? This is how often the way people preach. They just kind of speak and then later on they kind of figure out, I think this is what I'm supposed to have said, or a lot of times they don't even, doesn't dawn on them that they actually should have a purpose and it should be clear in their own idea, their own mind. You say, people don't really do that. They do. They do. Their goal is to preach a sermon. Their goal is not to do what their purpose of that sermon is. Their goal is just to get through the sermon. Especially when you're, you know, new. My goal is just to get through this thing, you know. Whether anybody's life has changed or not, it doesn't matter, but I just need to get through this, you know. So we really need to think in terms of the desired listener response. What's your goal in terms of how your audience is supposed to respond? All right? And I find it helpful to think in terms of what I want my audience to know. There's a knowledge base, intellectual. What I want them to feel, there's the emotional. And then what I want them to do in terms of the behavioral. You might say head, heart, and hands. And I always start it this way. The listeners will dot, dot, dot. I don't design my purpose in, I will say this. Because if I do that, the whole purpose is about me and what I'm trying to do. rather than the actual change that's supposed to happen in the listeners' lives. So my desired listener response for this class session will be, the listeners will understand the purpose of knowing where you're going in your sermon, and then they will preach with real direction and life change in their listeners.
Chloe? Right?
Yeah, you're getting it from the text. You're getting the central thought of what that text is saying, but that text is actually not specifically relating to your audience. So you have to think of how it's going to relate to your audience. So I would preach John 1 differently to you than I would to my father was married to a woman who pastored like a New Age church, kind of Christ consciousness church. People didn't really know Christ. And they asked me to come and speak some years ago. Now I thought, once I start telling them truly about Jesus, the real Jesus, I think it's going to be my only time I'm ever going to be able to have with this church to preach to them. And I was right. Once I preached once, they never asked me to come back again, you know? And I thought, I'm going to preach John 1. I'm going to tell them Jesus is God. And to all received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even those who believe in his name. And I'm going to pass out Bibles because it may be the first time they've ever seen a Bible. So my evangelical church in the neighborhood, this is Hawaii, gave me 7 Bibles because I was going to preach to these, you know, 14, 20 people, something like that. They were in this little church. So we passed out Bibles. And I said, okay, you know, we're going to be on whatever, page 892, whatever. And this is a little section I'm gonna give you. And I remember when we left and the people left, one of the ladies, she left and she pointed her purse. It looked kind of big and bulky. And she said, just to let you know, inside is one of those Bibles. It's like, I'm sneaking it out of the church. I'm sneaking a Bible because nobody's ever seen a Bible here in this church, you know. Like, I said, good, keep it, but pull it out of that Bible. Pull it out of that purse and read it.
This is a church.
Yeah, this is a church. This is a church of people that go to find out how they can be self-help. You know, people that don't know Christ. So I thought, I'm not going to go and preach to them something about, you know, how to live a Christian life, because they're not even believers. So I'm going to go give them an evangelistic message on John 1. But I've preached John 1 to other churches. I haven't told them how to come to know Christ. If I preached John 1 to you, I wouldn't be telling you guys how to come to know Christ, because you already know Christ. You see, my purpose would be different, but the text would actually be the same. But I would have a different desired listener response. Let me give you some examples. Page 86 is a sermon that talks about 2 Timothy 1:5 is the focus, but I have verses 1 to 6. It's on Mother's Day. I've given this at several different churches. You'll see I keep a list of which churches I've preached at the top and which dates. It talks about the influence that Timothy's mother had in his life. And so I try to be clear about what my purpose is. You'll see at the top of page 86, the listeners will thank and appreciate their mothers for their ministry in their lives. I'm trying to be as close as I can to the text. I think that's what Paul's telling Timothy. Look at the influence that your mother and your grandmother, Lois and Eunice, had in your life. Wow, I appreciate them, thank them. So I'm taking that and trying to make that a Mother's Day message. Paul told Timothy to do that. We should tell our mothers that. We should show that kind of appreciation to our mothers. Page 148. Jump to page 148, and you'll see my sermon again that I referred to earlier called Dirty Saints, based on Jesus washing the disciples' feet. What's my purpose in preaching that passage? Top of 148. The listeners will gladly do humble tasks for others. That's my goal. So if the people who hear me preach this, if they do that, if they're willing to humble themselves, for others, then they're being like Jesus. Jesus said, do to one another as I have done to you. Was he saying, wash one another's feet as I've done for you? Well, have I ever washed any of your feet? No. So am I not obeying Jesus? But have I done other things for you with a spirit of humility? You don't really need your feet washed. I mean, the streets are not really dirty here in Singapore like they were back in Israel. So you have other needs, but there's other ways I can show humility, show the love of Christ to you and to others. So you might say, oh, you're just spiritualizing it. Not really. I'm trying to apply it in this cultural context. Probably in other places in the world, you know, that don't have the kind of good roads that we have in Singapore, maybe you take that actually literally. Go ahead and wash your feet. I'm happy to do that. I did that once with our graduates, when we had our graduate dinner. Because we brought all the graduates up there, the 10, 15 students who are graduating, and I pulled out this bowl. I said, okay, everybody, let's take your shoes off. And then I just went one by one and washed all their feet. And then they graduated a few days after that. And they were like shocked. I never had a professor wash their feet before. But I wanted to show them. They didn't actually really need it because they all had clean feet anyway. It was easier for me to do that for them than it was for those in Jesus' time to actually really take those really dirty, dirty feet and do it. But the point is, I need to think in terms of where I'm going with this sermon. Page 156, Sermon on Missions. This one actually goes through the whole Bible. I call it, what in the world is God doing? It's a topical sermon. Starts in Genesis. You'll see in page 157, Genesis 3:15. Wow. God's missionary concern. You know, the seed of the woman will fatally wound the seed of the serpent. And it goes all the way to the book of Revelation. Revelation 7:9, God glorifying himself by redeeming a people from every people. So Genesis to Revelation. What's my goal? The listeners will see God's priority in missions. You know, this is missions all over the Bible. Genesis, Revelation. That's what I want them to see. And then commit themselves to be best used in the fulfillment of the Great Commission. What are you going to do with your life? Listeners, I want you to choose what you do, whatever job you have, based on whether it will help fulfill the Great Commission. Is that why you became an engineer? Is that why you became a pastor? Is that why you became a businessman? Because it's going to help fulfill the Great Commission? That should be your motivation. That was what I was trying to do there. Another purpose one. Keep going. Page 170 now. So here's this one's a monologue. We'll talk about monologues later. First person narrative where I came in as Ezra. Pretended I was Ezra, dressed up like Ezra and all that. But, you know, it's not enough just to say, oh yeah, I'm coming in to pretending as Ezra. I need to have a message. I need to know what my listeners are supposed to do. So my Ezra 9 monologue about intermarriage, the Jews were intermarrying with pagans. So my purpose, my subject and compliment was, you want a pure church? Well, weed out pagan influences in your own life first. You don't have a pure community without pure individuals. So are there things in your life like marrying non-Christians? Maybe you haven't married a non-Christian, but you got other non-Christian influences that are twisting your whole value system. Weed those out. So my purpose, the listeners will rid themselves of ungodly influences which wreck their own spiritual lives and eventually that of the church. I want them to think of themselves as individuals in a community. And I want them to eliminate this individualistic thinking that, oh, whatever I do for myself and in my own home, it only relates to me. No, it doesn't. Your personal life impacts the community. is what I want them to see. So be careful of the kind of influence of what you see in your own life. So I talk about pornography. I talk about television. I talk about movies. I talk about those kinds of things that that will help them not have pagan influences in their life, similar to what these unbelievers did in Ezra 9. Nehemiah 5. If I was going to preach Nehemiah 5, I would say, I want the listeners to show compassion for the poor instead of greed. Nehemiah sets himself up as an example. He says, I didn't take the governor's salary, because the people were in such distress. Well, isn't that a great example? That you're not there as a leader to enrich yourself. You show compassion for the poor. So I would talk about, maybe I would say it this way, see God's compassion through others if they're poor, and imitate God's compassion on the poor if they're wealthy. So here I have actually two different ways to preach this. Some of the people in my congregation, they're poor, and they need to see God's compassion in their life, that God is meeting their needs. But others are rich, so there's a different purpose actually for them. Sometimes I'll have a dual purpose in a sermon. If you're this, then it's this way. This is what I did last Sunday. I hate divorce, says the Lord. Well, how does that apply to the singles out there? I had teenagers in the audience. So I told them, I said, think about it. You're not married yet. God says, I hate divorce. Wow. Do you think that doesn't apply to you? It's huge. It says, and that one of the reasons God said, I hate divorce, is because the people were divorcing their Jewish wives and then marrying pagans. Are you committed as a single to not marry a non-Christian? And I said, would you commit before God right now as a single that you will not marry an unbeliever? I told him, I've made about 6 vows in my life. That is one of the most important vows I've ever made. Is it kept me from horrendous problems in my life, and has led to so many blessings in my life. I'm about the most blessed person that you can meet. Maybe you will disagree with me. You'll say, no, you're the most blessed person. A lot of this relates to marriage, because whoever you marry is going to determine where your life goes. You know, does it sound like I'm preaching the message again? I am, because I think it's so important for you as well. Now, how many of you are married? Raise your hands, okay. The married people sit in the front row. That's how it goes. And then Margaret. All right. Okay, the singles sit in the back row. Okay, that's interesting in this class. I have to keep that in mind. So I'm going to make my marriage applications to the front row, my single applications to the back row. All right, so really what we've got here, we got a bridge from the exegetical idea over to the homiletical idea. And so it can be helpful to understand what those two ideas are. So here's the two ideas, the passage idea and the sermon idea. Now, you're going to come up with your passage idea, your exegetical idea first, back to page 40. Once you've got that, then you get your sermon idea second. Don't get your sermon idea first and then force that passage to fit your idea. That's called eisegesis. That's forcing the text to do what you want it to do. So, in terms of place, the place you use your exegetical idea normally is in the study. That's where you determine that. And oftentimes, I don't ever bring my exegetical idea into the pulpit. I don't tell them what my exegetical idea is, because it's generally too long and cumbersome. So I'm trying to get everything in the passage in it. But the sermon idea should be in the pulpit. Sometimes the pulpit doesn't even have the sermon idea. That's pretty sad. When somebody comes through a whole sermon and people have no idea what the person said. You don't want that. So the steps would be observation and interpretation relating to the passage. your questions, your answers would be basically that. You're making observations. Those are questions. You're making interpretations. Those are the answers to those questions. Then when you go to the sermon idea, you're thinking, Tom, what is the principle here and how do we apply that principle? Your concern in the passage idea is accuracy. Am I saying what the text says to the author's intent? Your concern in the sermon is relevance. That doesn't mean you don't want it to be accurate, but you're recognizing that that text is not written to your audience. You know, I always write, and I mean always, my exegetical idea, the form into Z1X, Z2Y, because I found this so helpful. It just forces me to be clear of what I think the passage is saying. But I very, very rarely will bring that in the pulpit. Hardly ever. I have tried to have more of a slogan, more of a winsome, compelling, short, memorable idea. And so the length of the passage idea, 2 to 3 lines, I try never go actually 2 lines. I would say maybe 1 to 2 lines. The sermon idea, I'm getting shorter now. I'm actually going only 1 line. Here's my problem. I love preaching so much. My sermon idea is shorter, but my sermons are longer. I need to work on that. One of my former students wrote me today because I'm preaching at his church, and he said, without nagging, he said, just remember when you preach at my church, no more than 30 minutes. I thought, oh boy, did he go online to my sermon last Sunday? I set the record last Sunday, 1 hour and 15 minutes. Not last Sunday, 2 Sundays ago. That's the longest sermon I've ever preached at a church, you know. Maybe he went online and he discovered it, which happened to be the same passage I'm preaching at his church. I better cut out 45 minutes on this sermon here. I think I'm going to actually preach a different passage. You know, only 4 verses from the book instead of the whole book. That'll help.
So your slogan...
The CPS? It is the CPS in the sermon outline, in the sermon idea here. CPS, sermon idea, they're all the same thing.
So, slogan.
Yeah, and we'll have a whole session on this next time. I'll explain that more. But my outline is going to be sequential on the passage. My outline in the sermon is going to be logical. Sometimes the point of the passage is actually in the middle of your passage. And if that's really important to bring that out first, I'll say, hey, today we're doing verses 1 to 7. But the really guts of the passage is right there in verse 4. So let me see. This is what Jesus says in verse 4. And the whole passage really surrounds what Jesus says. So in light of that, I'm preaching in the more logical manner, you might say. Others will disagree with me. They'll say, no, that passage goes out like that. You should go straight through it. But I'm fine with that. But sometimes I will preach the passage in a logical manner. So I'll take the ultimate goal of the whole passage. Let me give you an example. Colossians 4:6. Just a little hint for you for next week. 2 weeks from now. Let your speech be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt, so that you may know how to respond to each person. You can see how that passage could be preached logically. Maybe even your exegetical idea would be logically designed. Maybe that passage is about how to know how to respond to each person. Do you catch what I'm saying? And then it's giving a couple ways to know how to respond to each person. That's still preaching the passage in the way that it's designed. But it's not preaching the passage in the way that it actually flows. Because the whole passage is bringing us to a so that. Right? If we know it's a so that, then we know that the exegetical idea is going to begin with the
the reason or the purpose, something like that. I think you guys are going to do great in this assignment. I think you're catching this. The passage idea is to be read. I want to read that and say, boy, I got that. I understand that. But the sermon idea is to be heard. The people ought to be able to catch it by ear without seeing it all written out. It shouldn't be so long. I've seen some sermon ideas that are 20, 30 words long. Okay, and the pastor or speaker will say, okay, here's the idea of what I want to say today. I'm like, okay, I got to the fourth word. What was the fifth word? What was the sixth word? You know, it's just too long. I'm saying as a listener, please do the hard work for me, Mr. Speaker, Mrs. Speaker. Please do that hard work. Boil it down to something I can grasp, something I can hear, something I can apply to my life. So the audience is time bound. And I give give an example here. Paul in the Colossians, or actually biblical times, actually. Whereas the audience here is timely, 21st century. In that sense, the tense was going to be past. You should be writing a past tense in your exegetical idea. The reason Paul told the Colossians, or the reason... the way Paul said the Colossians should do such, whatever. It's past tense. Whereas it's present tense for the sermon. What does God want us to do? What does God want us to be? God's desire today for you and me is for us to love in this manner, humbly serving others, or whatever it might be. The mood then is typically indicative for the passage. It's just a statement of fact where oftentimes it's imperative. Do this. Be this. Say this. Live this, etc. The person is third person for your passage. The person is first or second person. I should do this. We should do this. You should do this. For that one. The question of what was God speaking to them then becomes what God is saying to us, right? We should do this, we should say this, whatever. The needs that are mentioned, the questions that are, their answers are really original needs in the passage, but they're modern needs now. So our focus is not the text so much when we get to the sermon, it's going to be in our culture, in our day and age, what is it like? And then the purpose would be the passage is to summarize that passage, say what that passage is saying. But our purpose in the sermon outline is to really communicate to the people. To put those last two together, for example, if we would say what was the problem in the original audience in Corinth? The women wouldn't wear head coverings at Corinth. That was a problem Paul dealt with in 1 Corinthians 11. What did he say? Wear head coverings. The lack of a head covering was a sign in that society of rebellion to their husband, rebellion to society in general. Does God want women to indicate rebellion in the things that they wear? Do you know the answer to that question? Let's say for you ladies, to wear red in Singapore society is an indication that you are a loose woman who goes to bed with anybody. Do you think you should wear red to church? If that's what that communicates in society, I would hope you would avoid wearing red. Even if you have red things, you know, you wear them somewhere else. Do you catch what I'm saying? In this cultural context, you don't want to indicate something that's, it's totally dishonoring to the Lord, dishonoring if you're married to your husband, etc. Dishonoring to the leaders of your church. Okay, what do they have in common? Both the CPT and the CPS, write them in active voice. Not not was this or that, but the Corinthians did this. We should do this. Write them in full sentences. Don't give me an outline in this course with little phrases or words, because they don't communicate. Give me full sentences. Give me correlating Z1s and interrogatives. So if you say that the Z1 of that passage is the reason, da-da-da-da-da, whatever in the passage, what's your sermon going to be about? Yeah, what's your question you're going to address? It's going to be, what's the interrogative? Why? If that passage is why those women should wear head coverings, my sermon's going to be about why women should demonstrate a submissive spirit in a relevant way. By the way, you could preach a sermon about how men should show a submissive spirit too. But anyway. And then you do it so that it includes the whole passage. Your main idea should sum up the whole passage. Not pick and choose, like picking the favorite chocolate that you like out of the chocolate box we talked about earlier. Let's look at some examples. A mighty fortress is our God. You already did that one. But you wrote it long as a sentence. did I show you how I would preach that? Back to page 32. If you look at the bottom of 32, I never really went that far about Christ protecting us from Satan's powerful devices so we trust him. Look at the very last line of page 32. In step 5, we'll reword this. We can triumph over Satan only through Christ into a big idea like this. Trust Christ against Satan, not yourself. You see how that can be a good big idea? Only 6 words. Friends, how are you fighting your battle against Satan? That's my question I'm asking you. Trust Christ against Satan. Don't trust yourself. See, that's short enough for you to grasp. And my whole sermon is going to be that a mighty fortress is our God. You know, if that was my text. Matthew 18, 15 to 20. Look up page 34, C and D. We talked about this one, about church discipline. We asked a bunch of questions about the text. We talked about page 34C, and we came up with the reason the church should restore a sinning Christian correctly is because it extends God's authority. Okay, that still won't preach. That's a line and a half. I want to go down to desired listener response at the bottom of page 34C. And I have, the listeners will confess any sin in their lives worthy of church discipline and help others do so. Look at their lives and look at the lives of others. Who do they need to help? And do they need help themselves? That's my purpose. And when I get into the actual sermon, page 34D, my main idea is at the bottom. Restore sinners because you act for God. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 words. Now you can grasp that, you can hear that. Restore sinners because you act for God. You can grasp that, right? But you're not going to grasp the reason the church should restore sinning Christian correctly is because it extends God's authority. That's a lot harder. It's twice as long, right? Psalm 46, God's care. How are we going to sum up the whole Psalm 23? I say it at the bottom of page 46. God's good to you, so publicly worship him without fear. God's good to you, so publicly worship him without fear. That's Nehemiah 1, how God is sovereign. I want to have on page 116 a central idea that's simple about God's sovereignty. God was working through Nehemiah. So my main idea is God sovereignly gives us the needed vision, resources, and credibility to do his tasks. So have a that's a triple compliment main idea. Does God call you to a task like Nehemiah? See, I'm trying to keep the focus on God, not on Nehemiah. But he's given, God gives the vision, God gives the resources, God gives the credibility. And how's he doing it in your life? See, I'm trying to take those two chapters of Nehemiah and boil it down into one quick sentence. Love, page 153, John 13. If you love people like Jesus, you don't mind dirt. There's my dirty saints main idea. If you love people like Jesus, you don't mind dirt. I'm trying to avoid use of the word humility and all that, you know? Intermarriage, the monologue on Ezra, page 178. My main idea, bottom page 178, want a pure church? Weed out pagan influences in your own life first. Don't talk about having a godly church, a pure church, without weeding out pagan influences in your life. That's the essential idea of all that. There's a lot of other, some quick examples, okay? And then I'll call it a day on this session. Judges 16, the result of Samson's immorality with Delilah, with God's judgment upon him, the very life of the pagan temple of Dagon. That's where Samson's life ended up. The result of his immorality, God's judgment. Chuck Swindoll summarizes this, God judges any he-man with a she weakness. You got a she weakness? God's going to judge you. He's not going to just judge Samson. He's going to judge you too. I would say it maybe this way. What does sin bring? Pain. That's what sin brings. Pain. How about Jesus in Matthew 6? The manner in which the disciples were to pray that God rewarded was secretly rather than public show like the Pharisees. Does that sound familiar? That was one of the statements that you were making for today. If I was going to preach it, I wouldn't preach it that way. I'd say God blesses private prayers more than public. How are you doing in your private prayer life? So that's the focus I would bring in preaching it. How, or to bring this, the manner to the how. How can you pray with God's blessing? Pray with sincerity, not show. Do you see how that's can be easily heard rather than shown? John 13, the reason Jesus washed the disciples' feet was because he sought an example of love, humbly serving others. That won't preach, but I think it's accurate to the text. Mine is, when you love people like Jesus, you don't mind dirt. That's why I call it dirty saints. Dirty saints is a positive thing. We normally think of saints being dirty. Oh, that's bad. Jesus says it's good when you're getting dirty for him. Why not mind dirt? To serve humbly with love. I kind of like the first one better. But the second one brings in the idea of why we should be humble, to show love. How about 2 Corinthians 12? Paul says, I prayed about this three times, this thorn in the flesh, and God wouldn't remove it. He just said, my grace is sufficient for you. So the reason Paul stopped praying for his physical defect to be removed is because he began to value the humility and strength that built in him. That's my central idea of the passage. My preaching professor, Don Sanukian, he sums it up this way. The thing you most pray that God will remove in your life is the thing you most want to keep. That will preach. That'll get people thinking, really? The thing that I can't change, that I keep asking God about to change, it's him or it's her or it's this or it's that. Do you value what God wants to do in your life more than him changing that?
I was going to say, what if the thing I'm praying God for in my life is sin? I'm having a deep struggle with whatever.
If the thing that you're praying for the most is sin, then maybe we have an exception here. then you're in alignment with the Lord, that He would do that in your life. So maybe it would be good to observe the objection, possible objection that people would have. Say, well, if it is sin, it wasn't sin in Paul's life, so that wouldn't be parallel if it's sin for you. So that would be an exception.
So,
go ahead, Natalie, and then we'll...
No, I guess because I mean, from what I read on the left, so what I read on the right, it doesn't seem like Paul was trying to
Well, here, when you're shifting to the homiletical, you have to say, how specific am I going to be? Paul called it a thorn in his flesh, a difficulty in his body. We don't know what it was. Some say it was his eyesight. Some say it was malaria. We don't really know what it was, but it was a physical thing. Maybe instead of saying the thing, maybe a better way to do your homiletical ideas. What is it about your body? What is it about your physical body that you used to struggle with the most? Are you willing for God? Do you want to be like Jesus more than you want that thing changed in you? Some of you feel you're too short. Others think you're too tall. Others think they're too fat or too skinny. Or you wish you had, you know, you envy me because I don't have glasses on. You've got glasses on. Or whatever it might be, you know? You should know that I had glasses for many, many years. Horrible eyesight, but God brought a guy into my life to give me LASIK surgery, and now I can see pretty well now. But, you know, anyway, maybe Dr. Sanookian is going too broad with the application. You feel uncomfortable with that because you've given a good response to say, well, that doesn't really apply if you're talking about sin. So maybe what we ought to do is what a confine the application more toward a physical struggle that we have. Why does so-and-so have so much energy and I don't have so much energy? Why does, you know, you think about something that's relating to something that you would ask God three times or more, would you change this about me, you know? What is it that you struggle with about you, about your body? It's going to be different things for each one of us. All right, Ping, what's your thought?
Whether when we come out with a slogan or a message idea, it seems to me that the audience is like the main
yeah, you want to preach it in such a way that that audience can reply it.
Instead of like, let's say looking at the text is more like the faithfulness, accuracy to the team and the trust. But it seems to me like there is a big difference when you look at these two. Although it's supposed to be the same, but
yeah,
you guys
are you're doing a great job. You're taking you're not critiquing me. You're taking my preaching professor and you're critiquing him. It's easier because he's not here. You know, he'll be here. I've asked him to come and teach our DMN course next two years from now. He said, "Well, I'll be 81 by then, but if I'm still living, I'll come." But you're doing the right thing. Maybe this is not the best way to do it. The passage Paul brings us to, I asked God about this three times, this physical defect, and God said, my grace is sufficient for you. So that's not going to be parallel to what Natalie said. You know, oh Lord, reveal this, take this sin away from my life. And God says, no, I'll give you grace for that sin. You know, that's not parallel. What's parallel is something that we struggle with physically. You know? All right. Why stop praying? Oh, that maybe someday when I preach, I'll preach this. Today, I'm going to tell you to stop praying. All the other pastors, they always tell you, you should pray. Today, I'm going to tell you why you should stop praying. Okay, you guys want to stay for this sermon? You know? hopefully my listeners will go, did I just hear that guy? Did I hear him right? Did he just say he's going to tell us to stop praying? Yeah, that's the subject of my message today. You can leave if you want, but if you want to know why you should stop praying, go ahead and stay.
And of course, nobody's going to leave, you know. And I'll say, let's go to 2 Corinthians 12. Because Paul talked about how, why he stopped praying. This thing he committed to God over and over. And God said, stop praying because my grace is sufficient for you. I don't want you praying about this anymore. I want you to accept my plan for your life. Maybe you think you're not attractive enough for someone to want to marry you. Are you willing to give that up to the Lord? You think, boy, I don't... Who would want to marry me? You know, physically. Like, you think you should be better looking or whatever. So stop praying about it. Stop praying that way. God spoke to me that way back in... back in 1981. And I said, I'm going to stop praying for a wife. Because I don't even know if it's God's will that I would get married. And I keep praying that God would turn Susan's heart toward me so she'll want to marry me. But I don't know if it's God's will. So I said, all right, Lord, I'm going to stop praying that. I'm going to start praying that I would be the kind of person someone would want to marry. And I said, and I'm not going to pray that way anymore. Well, you know what happened? 2 weeks later, all of a sudden, God turned Susan's heart toward me. So here's the principle. Once you stop praying, within 2 weeks... No, I can't. That's the wrong principle, of course. The point is, God doesn't want us to pray about everything. We think he does. But some things he wants us just to relax, give over to him, and submit to his sovereignty. Because he says, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness. So Paul says, therefore, all the more gladly, I'll boast about my weaknesses. So anyway. So, if I was going to do Ephesians 6, I would kind of do it this way. The way Ephesians fathers should raise their children was by guiding rather than provoking them. Here's my desired listener response. The fathers will replace provoking with guidance. That's my goal in this sermon. I want those fathers out there to say, I'm not going to provoke anymore. I'm going to guide. No provoking, only guiding. What's my main idea? Dads, don't nag. Teach. That's four words for the main idea. Dads, don't nag. Teach. Levy? What's that?
Can you replace dads with parents?
With what?
Parents.
I would say it this way, specifically to dads. I would say it that way, but then I would also follow it up with, you know, maybe in your home, maybe the dads have caught on to this, but the moms haven't. This passage doesn't specifically refer to the moms, but sometimes moms have a real difficulty here, and the dads are doing okay on it. Moms, does this apply to you? I mean, is God speaking to you, even though this is not directly to you? This is what we would call a secondary, extended application. I don't want the ladies go, okay, good. I can nag and nag and nag, because this passage doesn't apply to me at all. You know, I don't want anybody to feel like they can get away with sin because of what I've said in the passage, because I've become so narrow. But the passage is specifically talking to men, so I want to talk to men, but I'll give an extended application as well. Lot more things to say, but not a lot more time, and we do need to end this session. But let me see if I could just give you one more, and then we'll call it. This is on. I'm jumping to slide 32. This is the reason the church should restore a sinning Christian correctly because this restoration is carried out as an extension of God's authority. I think that's what Matthew 18 is saying. But that's not going to preach. It's not going to preach. It's too long. I think it's exegetically out, you know. I would say it this way. We restore sinning members properly because we act on God's behalf. Why do we try to, you know, do this in this church? Why do we try to restore sinning members properly? Because we're acting on God's behalf. I think that's still a little bit too long. So I would say it this way. Restore sinners because you act for God.
Now, that will preach. Do you have a ministry to restore sinners because you act for God? Do you even try to restore sinners? I hope you do. And I hope you do because you realize that God has actually extended some of his authority through you. You have a role to play here. If anyone sins against you, go show him his fault privately. That applies to any Christian. That's not just to Christian leaders. All of us have a responsibility to help one another, to help restore people. You are acting for God. You catch it? So that hopefully people would see, ooh, this is not just a passage for our church leaders. I have a role to play here as well. I don't want anybody to get through with my sermon and go, well, that was for so-and-so. I don't want anyone to do that. I want everyone to say, well, I think that was really for me. I need to do this. May it be so in your life and mine.